on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hi there and welcome to Sunday Night on ABC Radio, around Australia and via the web to the world. Well, periods of economic hardship such as that we're enduring around the world at the moment, and also in Australia with the particular problems caused by the rural drought and the current financial meltdown, are linked to increased social stress. It's pretty obvious. But one bleak indicator is the rise in suicide. For those left behind, the pain is amplified. This evening, we're going to discuss postvention. Not prevention, that is how to prevent suicide, but postvention, how to deal with the trauma of those left behind, supporting those bereaved by suicide. It's the theme of a Melbourne conference this week, and in a few moments we'll be joined by some of the local and international participants in the conference to talk about suicide, prevention and postvention. Our guests are all concerned with those feelings. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program this evening Dr. Frank Campbell of the Crisis Centre Foundation in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and who's been involved in developing over the years an active postvention model for those who have been bereaved through suicide. Dr. Sheila Clark of Adelaide, who co-facilitated the Bereaved by a Suicide Support Program in Adelaide and is currently in private practice, and Dr. Adrian Bonner of the United Kingdom, who is reader in the Institute of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of Kent and founder and director of the Addictive Behaviour Group. Welcome to you all. Thanks for joining us here on Sunday Night. Let me come, perhaps, Frank Campbell, to you first. The pain of suicide is particularly difficult for families and friends left behind because, as I indicated, of the aura of failure on their part being made worse by the hint of stigma that is still attached to the act. That stigma is an ancient feeling. It's almost as though suicide is a rejection of life and something that we simply can't allow people to do of their own volition. It's almost in some ways a visceral denial that we're involved with here.
Well, certainly thousands of years of stigma have been placed on families especially. But I would say that the community also wonders what they could have done quite often when a death occurs by suicide. So the confusion and the pain and the whole question of why, what could they have done to change this, leads to a sense of helplessness at times, which is important for the theme of the conference this week, was a link to hope, to help families know that following suicide, there are things they can do to take care of themselves, because I think most families and communities are fearful there will be additional suicides.
Sheila Clark, let me ask you, as somebody who's co-facilitated the Breathe Through Suicide Support Group in Adelaide, over the years, what led you to a concern with the after the act rather than before the act, with postvention?
Well, when I first started back in the middle 80s, there were absolutely no services for people bereaved through suicide. In fact, it wasn't long. I mean, you talked about stigma being an ancient feeling, but it wasn't long since suicide had actually been decriminalised in South Australia. And this was inherited from the history of the church and the state trying to band together to prevent suicide by stigmatizing suicides by actually posting them along the roads, and they were called the crossroads, as a warning to other people not to take their lives. And I think this has created a huge stigma in the past, which has been very difficult for people to deal with. And so back in the middle 80s, there were really no services for people until Mr. Harold Jones, a funeral director, identified the need, and he was the person who set up this support group. And I think this is probably the first one in South Australia. And I was very much aware, working in that group, that there were no resources, there were no written resources, there was no one trained in this area, there was nowhere for people to go, no telephone supports, no one who was really experienced in this area. And so that's what really made me start to intensely work in this area.
Of course, for the person who has died by suicide, I mean, there in one sense is an end of it. The grief process is something that is left with those who remain behind, and then you have this addition of the stigma laid upon the grief, the stigma that somehow not only have they failed, but there is shame associated with their failure. This is a trauma that somehow bypassed us until, as you say, Sheila, people began to talk about it in the 1980s. But an extraordinarily wide group of people must be affected by this.
Absolutely. And I feel that they feel that they have failed. But in actual fact, when they tell their stories, they have been extraordinarily tenacious and courageous and supportive of the person who has died, particularly those who have been attempters, and what they don't see is that they are not failures. They probably have kept the person alive for a lot longer because of their because of the support that they've been giving the people. But sometimes they feel, well, yes, I perhaps I did miss something. Perhaps I should have done this. And there are the if-onlys. And I think that that's a very normal thing, that one can identify these signs in retrospect. And one has to be very careful looking back and feeling that one has been a failure, or that one is guilty, or perhaps has feelings of failure or feelings of guilt, when one necessarily has not failed or actually is guilty. And so I think it's very important for these people to try and rationalise their guilt and look at it from the point of view of the context at the time. Because I think these are really burdens that are additional to losing a loved one, those burdens that because of the mode of death. And we talk about the importance of postvention, not just for easing these burdens, but also because postvention is prevention for the next generation.
Just give me briefly some sort of figure on this. So how many people are committing suicide in Australia per year, and what's the multiplier there when you go to those then who are directly affected?
Okay. In 2005, which is the latest national figures we have, there were just over 2,101 who took their lives. And when we think of that, we often say that there are at least 10 people who are seriously affected by a suicide death, or by any death. Close family members, after a suicide, there are often those who have cared for the person who took their life, such as the doctor or the social worker, and there may be teachers or carers or workmates or close friends as well. So there are many people who are affected. I mean, also, if the suicide attempt was a public event, then there may be those who actually witnessed that who also need care and some support.
Adrian Bonner, let me bring you into the conversation here. You're one of those concerned with sustaining and those individuals who are threatening to attempt suicide. You're one of those who has actually, through study, found that, in fact, among disadvantaged groups, we can expect that there would be a tendency towards depression and suicide, but you're one of those who are saying there are actually some encouraging things here that in some ways appear rather prosaic, but in fact, even things as simple as diet can affect the potential of people who are likely to commit suicide.
Yeah. First of all, it's very good to be here in Australia for these few days, and I should say that my own research is based around the Salvation Army's homeless services in the UK, and we're pleased to be talking with people in Australia with similar sort of work. The work, which is actually available on Google, is a report called Seeds of Exclusion, and it's a detailed set of interviews with over 1,000 people using homeless services. And from this, we've discovered that about 36% of the men and 47% of the women have previously attempted to take their own lives. So within the homeless sector, certainly within the UK, we're dealing with a very vulnerable and sort of high-risk group for suicide. But having said that, if we look at the number of deaths due to suicide in the Salvation Army population, service users, remember we have about 20,000 per year using the services in the UK, I think during the last 3 years, 7 completed suicides have taken place. So it's a remarkably low number in comparison with the very high risk group. What we're trying to do now is to understand that, first of all, the homeless population is just not one homogeneous group of people. We tend to think of it in thirds. A third of the homeless people clearly do have some mental health and alcohol-related problem. Another third are economically homeless because of either job losses or whatever. And the other third are homeless because of relationship problems, loss of the family home, whatever. So really, we've got a chance to intervene with these people at a critical time in their lives. And as you mentioned, John, one of our main sort of interests is actually a nutritional intervention which would support other psychological and spiritual dimensions of care. I'm not sure how much detail...
Let me just ask one other question on that. At one level, it's an interesting insight. At another level, it's terribly prosaic. Because when you think of people who are exposed to the elements as they may be when they're homeless, but also liable to depression, then, of course, one of the things that will go down the drain is their diet. It's the way they eat. And you're saying that actually, if you intervene even in simple ways, such as making sure they have a regular and well-balanced diet, then that can be part of the heal or the reparation process.
The people we're talking about have a whole range of complex needs, which do include depression, panic attacks, PTSD, and suicidal tendencies. And although a balanced diet is important in terms of maintaining vitamin levels, vitamin B complexes are particularly important there, we're particularly interested in those aspects of nutrition which affect serotonin levels in the brain. You probably know, or your listeners know, that serotonin is quite important in terms of antidepressant drugs, but we're using a non-pharmacological approach initially to say that if we can boost serotonin levels in the brain through dietary manipulation of, for instance, carbohydrates and proteins in the normal meal, there's a chance of increasing brain levels of serotonin, which is quite important in raising the threshold for suicidal thoughts and suicidal actions. The importance of that can be seen in some rather complicated studies, because you can't really study this metabolism in people going through this process. But what has been determined over the years is that the levels of serotonin in the post-mortem brains of suicide victims contain little or no serotonin. Mm. So what we've got to try to do is to lift the levels of serotonin through diet. And that's feasible using the sort of approaches which we're going to be talking about this week in Melbourne and Sydney.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're talking about connectedness, a link to hope, the second Australian postvention conference. And postvention refers to helping those who are survivors of suicide. That is, if a loved one is lost to suicide, what's to do with the larger group who are affected by both the guilt and shame and grief of losing a loved one to suicide? Now, you may be in that group. You may be touched by suicide. You may have family members touched by suicide. There may be those in your neighbourhood that you feel could be helped or talked to. Do join us. 1-800. I'll give you the number. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222, and do give us a call. 1-300-800-222 on Sunday night. A chance to talk to some world experts in the field. Sheila Clark from South Australia, Dr. Frank Campbell from the United States, and Dr. Adrian Bonner from the United Kingdom, here in Australia for the Link to Hope Postvention Conference. Frank Campbell, let me come back to you. We had a little trouble early hearing you, but I think our levels are all sorted out now. Frank, you're one of those who spent a fair bit of time looking at those who are survivors of friends and loved ones who've committed suicide. You've developed an active postvention model of how to intervene and help those, support those who have been bereaved through suicide. Just give us a little outline of how that model works.
Well, much like Sheila, we began work in 1981 with bereaved by suicide individuals at our crisis center, which had been in operation since 1970. And what we saw on a regular basis, John, was that there was a long elapsed time between death and stumbling onto resources like the support group. In fact, the average length of time in the research that I conducted was 4.5 years. This said that people that had been out there in a lot of pain on their own without any resources. So my goal was to get a team that would respond when the death occurs as a first responder, just like the police and the coroner.
It's like the St. John's Ambulance in a way.
Very much like that. And we go to the scenes as volunteers, many of which themselves have been bereaved by suicide, have gotten into the group, have gotten to a point in their life where they're able to be altruistic and respond without that creating any kind of negative concept for themselves by re-exposure. And what they do is they go to the scene and they provide information. We're trained in crime scene etiquette, and we're able to work right alongside the other first responders. But primarily, we provide support to the newly bereaved and the installation of hope that there is a place, much like this conference theme, to link them to something beyond this moment where they are completely confounded by this event that's happened in their life. And what we have found, our 11-year study right now shows that our average elapsed time, if they get a lost call, is 47 days between us being with them at the home and them coming in our center for the free support that we provide. And that's a significant drop, as you can imagine. And it ensures that people at least are aware. Now, we average seeing 10 people at the scene. And as Sheila said, there's this unknown number that's really out there. My research has identified 45 unique relationships that came in. And you got to remember, as she said, there's collateral exposure. It could be a housekeeper in a hotel walking in on a body. It could be a person who dies in a very public setting, like jumping from a high place where there's a risk of even additional harm. So our team, it's called the LOST team, and the acronym stands for Local Outreach to Suicide Survivors. And in Perth, the Arbor program has taken that model, so has Singapore and other countries adopted it, and it's been quite successful.
One of the things that struck me in what all of you have said is the extent to which that intervention in this area is remarkably successful. That is, that it's so often that just making the connection can begin to have direct and quite dramatic effects. Sheila?
Yes, I think there can be an enormous relief for people who are just so distressed and feeling so many negative emotions just overwhelming them and feeling so confused, to be able to touch base with someone either who's been through it themselves, who's trained in helping, or with a professional, or just with a caring community around them. And there are various here in Australia, there are various means for people to get support. There are support groups in many of the larger metropolitan areas. There are telephone counselling services. There's much more upskilling of mental health professionals in the area of postvention. And there are pathways to that help that are known. So that there is access to various forms of help, right from the very early stages, right the way on as far as people as long as people need that.
And we'll put some of those up on our website after the program tonight. If you're listening and want to participate, 1-300-800-222, give us a call, and we'll put the details of a number of these support groups on our website this evening, which is abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S if you've got your computer handy. Let me ask all three of you one other question before we do take some calls from listeners. I mentioned early that the shame and guilt associated with that, and we touched on the history of this, the way it had been stigmatized both religiously and civilly as a way of sort of preserving life. Do you find there are in multi-faith communities, particularly the sorts of societies that we're entering into in the West over the last 20 years, that really you need to be culturally sensitive here as well, that there are different cultural attitudes to suicide? I mean, we traditionally in Christian Western countries, we're used to the difference in the Catholic and Protestant attitudes, but now we're in communities in which Muslims, Buddhists, Jews, Christians, but I'm thinking particularly of the difference between, say, Islam, Catholicism and Protestantism that you get in contemporary Western societies that you have to be sensitive to. Frank Campbell.
Well, I definitely think all cultural environments make a difference. But then there's just this larger social context where we do everything from make jokes about suicide and put it on menus in restaurants as suicide by chocolate or buffalo wings with suicidal sauces, to condemnation and sanctions and prohibitions that are antiquated. So we have this ambivalence about a cause of death that then bleeds over onto all those people that are affected by it with a sense of confusion about how society will or won't support them once suicide occurs in their life. So they have a tendency to be very secretive and closed off, and they lose that supportive community. And I was thinking, as Adrian was talking about the services being provided through meals, I mean, one of the other direct benefits of that is the sense of community and connectedness that is offered as a way of prevention. But see, families are often separated from that following suicide. They feel a closed off, walled off environment.
Adrian Bonner, Britain has become rapidly a multicultural society. Are there different profiles with the different cultural groups? And particularly I'm thinking of the Muslim-Christian divide.
I don't have any data at hand to actually support that, but I certainly know that the faith-based communities are very important in supporting people, not only in terms of the early childhood support and building up of resilience and protection at an early stage, but also when people do get into trouble, really ignoring the religious divides between particular religious sects. What they all have in common is a faith base and the development of relationships, which seems to be a key point in the development of resilience and mitigating against the suicidal thoughts. Or at least once the thoughts are there, supporting group, no matter which faith group we're dealing with, should really be developing relationships, not putting a person in a cocoon and providing huge amounts of Christian love in a vacuum, but engaging with that person to bring them into the community and integrating the person into the community.
Sheila Clark, I'm thinking particularly whether any of those sort of subcultural groups still hang on to the old stigma in depth more than some other cultural groups.
Well, yes, I've been to many international conferences in which there certainly have been differences shown from the in the attitude to suicide in the different cultural groups and in the different faiths. But I think I'd just like to take that from a slightly different point of view here.
Sure.
In Australia. I think really we have two cultures here, a metropolitan one and a rural one.
Mm.
And I think in the metropolitan areas, the stigma is very much reduced. And I think one of the reasons for that is that there is, when you're in a big town or big metropolitan area, there is confidentiality. No one else knows that you're going for counselling. Whereas in a rural area,
suicide seems to be everybody's business and talked about. So the stigma can still seems to be still much more in a rural community than in metropolitan communities. And I have noticed over the years, working with people bereaved through suicide, that many of them now say they haven't felt any stigma, and the people around them who've they've connected with haven't felt any stigma, and they've received a lot of support. And in some ways, it's good to talk about stigma because it actually helps to relieve to give a sense of relief to those who feel stigma that is quite normal. But on the other hand, it does help to continue the stigma. So I think we're in a bit of a bind here, and I prefer really not to talk about stigma because then to talk about how to help people bereaved through suicide to normalise that it's that it's important to connect with people and how to connect with people and how helpful that can be. And I think connectedness comes much more when there is actually less stigma around. And I think people coming from a multi-faith or other cultures into Australia, because of the language difficulties, often don't tend to go for help to counselling services because of the difficulties in communicating about how they actually feel. So they may be the people who actually who really need more help than they're actually receiving at the moment.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. If you've been touched by suicide, you'd like to share your feelings or ask the advice of any of our guests, Dr. Frank Campbell of the Crisis Centre Foundation in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who's developed an active postvention model to support those bereaved by suicide. Sheila Clark of Adelaide, Dr. Sheila Clark, who co-facilitated the Bereaved Through Suicide Support Group in Adelaide some years ago. And Dr. Adrian Bronner of the United Kingdom, who was working principally in the area of suicide prevention and has written on diet and depression and suicide and social exclusion. Please feel free to join us, 1-300-800-222. We'll now take some of your calls. Let's say hi to Ian in Melbourne. Ian, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us. What would you like to say?
Yes, thank you. Just in regards to both sides of the issue, is one is the cause effect, and then obviously the grieving process that goes on afterwards. Now, I've been involved in at least a dozen suicides in my time. My background is an ambulance paramedic, but not all were. A lot of them were personal. Mm. There's one area that always keeps coming up on every single case is stomach pain and anxiety. Every single person that committed it. Now, I've dealt with people that have been wealthy, with a girlfriend or boyfriend, that have had a good job, everything's going well in their life, and then to the other scheme, to the other side of, you know, people being having anxiety from, you know, lack of money and so forth. But one consistent thing that was always there was that they wake up in the mornings with a bellyache. It was just a pain in their stomach. Everybody had it. Whether they were, that is the cause. Now, afterwards, the way I've tried to deal with it is because I've had to deal with the people afterwards as well. Like tonight, for instance, I've just had a friend of mine, her son committed suicide a few days ago. And she didn't want to talk to anybody, and I've spoken to, I was the first one to speak to her tonight because she had to get it out, and it's like a SIDS case. They don't know what to do. They take blame upon themselves. It's not their fault.
Indeed, it's not. And you're wanting a response from our panel. Perhaps first, Adrian Bonner, the observations, the medical or paramedic observations there about the phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly what we're talking about there is this fight and flight response and the what we might say the autonomic part of the body taking over, causing various aspects of stress to be quite extreme in people. And that really is, as you might expect, linked to the high level of emotion being expressed and being felt by that person. And this is where the dilemma comes, because really you've got a trade-off between a high emotional response and a very poor cognitive or, you know, thinking approach. So I think first responders and others really you've got to somehow break through that emotional response to make very simple, help the person make simple judgments. Now that occurs both in terms of helping people about to undertake an act of suicide, but also, I presume, from a postvention point of view, if we can, on the one hand, deal with the grief, deal with the emotion, but also let the light of rational thought develop as well, that might be part of the recovery process. But that's a very long, drawn-out thing. It's a very glib comment for me to make, but it's the trade-off between emotional and cognitive responses which we've got to consider there.
And Frank Campbell, you've been one of active in the first responder area.
Well, certainly. First of all, I think it's just really important to thank Ian for what he's done. He's reached out to someone with a very grievous recent loss, and he's not been willing to take no for an answer. He's saying, we've got to talk, we've got to do this, and his paramedic background also complements his first responder knowledge. But I think an often unspoken collateral damage are all the first responders that do come in contact with suicide at such a high frequency compared to the general population, and it has some cumulative effect as well. I haven't heard the stomach connection. We certainly hear a lot more about psychological pain, and I think the point Adrian makes is a good one. But with males who do tend to die by suicide so much more, we also know that men often somaticize their emotional pain, and it produces more physiological responses and back aches and neck aches and stomach ache and cholinergic issues that could be being reported by the family afterwards, because certainly with a paramedic, they would be more likely to report to you any physical acknowledgments that might have been passed on by the deceased, especially in those initial moments upon discovery and paramedics arriving. But the thing that I really have to underline is that he has allowed this mother to begin to talk and not be isolated with all the overwhelming thoughts that she has. I agree with Sheila that my experience is that families have done an incredible job of helping, and that it's in a societal issue that we all need to be able to be aware of what we can do to reach out. But that most families, when they finally get a chance to talk with other survivors, realize that these are regrets they're expressing. And we all have regrets. We all, once something like this happens, we all look back and see things we would have liked to have done better or different. But at no point do we do them with a sense of harm intended. And that's where guilt would be more appropriate. So I do think for many survivors, guilt is the word they grab, when in fact what they're really saying is they just miss their loved one and they wish they had him.
Mm. Ian, thanks so much for your call. We are going to have to move on. We've got lots of calls on the board, but thanks for your contribution, and thanks for the work you're doing. We need to move on. We're going to stay in Melbourne, though. We're going to be talking to Ron in Melbourne. Hello, Ron. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
I'd just like to thank you all for trying your best to help people, and I think that needs to be appreciated in your program. Look, I'd like to suggest there needs to be a new grief and support group, not modelled on present do-nothing type groups that exist at the moment, including Beyond Blue, I believe is a waste of public money. I think we need massive support to assist services for volunteers to assist people. I believe that all the welfare groups and state government departments in Victoria are useless, and I believe the reason is we have useless ombudsmen and our Westminster system, which gives us cretin politicians and the cretin staff mainly at a state level, and 85% at the federal level, and we need a telephone-based complaint system to make politicians do their job to assist people, and also welfare services must assist all people, not just people in their region, and have proper ombudsman complaint systems to make them do their job.
Well, I think there's more than a complaint about suicide services there, Sheila, but I'll throw this one to you, that we do need a more structured system to be developed.
Well, yes, I would have, if it was back in the 1990s, I might have said yes, but the at the beginning of about 2000, the Commonwealth took on this issue of postvention, and in about 2007, they released over $13 million for quite a number of national projects in the area of postvention. Which were example projects and research projects looking at how they could help people in various ways in the community, from the first response to looking at the long-term needs of people. And these are being done in the various states. There are also a number of state-funded projects and community-funded projects. There are quite a number of really good, a lot of really good work that's being done now in Australia. And the purpose of the conference, of course, was to draw a lot of these people together, to network, to cross-fertilise ideas, to share the learnings from these projects, and so that the Commonwealth can go ahead and the states can go ahead and do some long-term planning from here onwards. So we are in the process, I think, of something that's going to be very constructive coming out of this.
Thanks for your call, Ron. Hope that's gone some way to answering your grievances, but I think there's a few more on your list that need to be dealt with elsewhere. Stephanie, let's say hi to Stephanie. Stephanie, welcome to the program. What would you like to say?
Yes, thank you. Community counselling services sometimes encourage a family to disclose what has happened to their young children if it's the parent who's died. If the child is exhibiting traits similar to the parent, would disclosure actually be setting up or encouraging that child toward the same behaviour? And also, what is the best way to help such a child, say, under 10 years old?
Sheila Clark.
Yes, I think this is a very difficult issue that families have to face. You know, what do we tell the children? And I've known of families that haven't told the children, and the child has discovered what actually happened to their father or their elder brother, perhaps through a friend or the school. And the problem here is that the child here has not only lost that relative, but they've also lost the confidence of the rest of the family. And I think it's very important that the family do engage in telling the child something about the death, either that the person has taken their life, but without giving them the details. And often putting it in the context of that the person was sick and didn't know how to go for help, but then also educating the child if they felt so bad, where would they go for help? And making sure that there were nominated people that they could go to, not necessarily a parent or someone in the family, but there was someone that the child felt confident enough to going to ask for help. So I think it needs to be put in a particular context and an educational way for the child, but I think it's important not to to disclose the actual details of how the person took their life.
Stephanie, anything further you want to add?
Is there any means of postvention for small children? I mean, as far as that's a way to go and get help, but as far as in a health situation, is there any way to immediately start to treat that child if you have fears for that child?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I think it's very important to go and get professional help for the child, either through the general practitioner or through the child and adolescent mental health services. or certain psychologists are skilled, and certain psychiatrists are also skilled in child psychology, and a lot of, and they may get through to the child in play therapy with these sort of deal with these sort of issues through play therapy and etc. or art, or so it's important, I think, for them to go and get some help for their child.
Stephanie, we'll be putting up on our website this evening a number of the places where you can go for help. So if you want to go to the website, which is www.abc.net.au/Sunday Nights, we'll be putting the addresses and contact points of a number of the postvention services and other services available. Thanks for your call. Thanks for sharing with us. Adrian Bonner, we've had a number of calls, and I'm trying to sort of collect a few together because we've got so many calls on the board. There's a continuing stream of calls asking for details on your diet and serotonin observations, and you did say that you had a paper which was up on the web already that people can access if they want to.
Yes. Well, in fact, we're writing papers for the academic journal. It's not on the web as such, but we're moving towards that. Very briefly, a good, sound, balanced diet is important, and as I briefly mentioned before, the main thing really is to maintain good levels of the brain chemistry of serotonin. This is really important even before we get into antidepressants, which often work on similar systems in the brain.
So there are natural ways of boosting serotonin?
Oh yes, yeah. It's not possible to go out to your health food shop and buy tryptophan, which is the starting point. That really is not easily converted into serotonin in the brain. What you do have to do is to change the competing amino... tryptophan is an amino acid, and it's competing with other amino acids to get through to the brain and then form serotonin. That sounds a bit sort of scientific, but in simple terms, you can achieve that by altering the levels of carbohydrate and protein in your diet. For instance, if you've got more than 5% of protein in the diet, in a particular meal, that will not allow this tryptophan to go through to the brain and form serotonin. So clearly, more of a carbohydrate-driven diet in the evenings would be quite important.
More carbs, less protein in the evenings.
In the evening, because serotonin levels are important in themselves in reducing cravings for alcohol, increasing sense of well-being, and a whole range of other positive behavioural things. But also, serotonin is the starting point for melatonin, produced after midnight or in the dark phase, which is really quite essential to maintain a good sleep-wake cycle. In other words, people who have major sleeping problems do not produce melatonin as part of that range of issues in sleep deprivation.
Adrian, that's excellent news for all we pasta eaters.
Yeah,
after
yeah.
the local Italian restaurant, yeah. pig out in the evenings, I'm feeling very good about myself.
Evenings, not mornings, though. You need to get up and go in the mornings.
You're on Sunday Nights on ABC Radio around Australia, 1-300-800-222. We're talking about suicide postvention. That is the great trauma suffered by many, many, many who have to deal with the consequences of the suicide of a loved one. Grief, shame and other things that crowd in. Where do you go for help? Well, we're talking with some of the leading experts in the world who've gathered in Melbourne this week for a conference, Connectedness, A Link to Hope. And our guests this evening, Dr. Frank Campbell, Dr. Sheila Clark and Dr. Adrian Bonner. And you, of course, on 1-300-800-222. And Stephanie was just on the line. We're going to take a call now from Simone in Coffs Harbour. Simone, thanks for joining us. What would you like to say? Simone, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What would you like to say?
Depression is all-consuming.
Indeed.
Well, you do want to commit suicide. And every day you wake up and you don't do it.
You're somebody who's felt the sting of depression?
Yeah.
And you're somebody who would like to get support or somebody who's got advice for others?
There's no support.
There's no support? Sheila, what would you say to somebody in Simone's position?
Yeah, Simone, I'm very, my heart goes out to you. It can be a very, very lonely feeling of when one's depressed, and one can feel just so disconnected from people and in a darkness all of one's own. And Simone, this is often how people feel, but there are people out there who want to help you. There are people who can help you.
No.
And it may feel as if no one can help you because you are so depressed. But allow people to help you, family, friends, counsellors, medical profession, allow them to help you. And slowly, slowly, you will get better. And you will see the joy
in life again. I'm sorry, but you're talking a lot of crap.
It may seem that because of how you feel at the moment. At the moment, life might seem very, very dark. But there is hope out there. There is hope for a better life for you. And you are a valuable person, a good person. You've phoned in and you've been honest and about how you feel, and that must take a lot of courage, and that says a lot about you. And it is important for you and for all of us, that you go and allow people to help you.
Simone, thanks for your call. What I'm going to suggest is that you stay on the line, and we'll just take, if you want to leave us with a contact, we'll take a contact for you. And if you want to talk about somebody in your area who you've got help for or you need some help from, then we can make sure that that's... that you're given some help with that. So if you just stay on the line, Simone, we'll try and facilitate some support there around your area. That's Simone. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Helen in Victoria. Helen, welcome to you. What would you like to say?
I would like to say that my mother, I got addicted to painkillers for arthritis. The more I tried to keep saving her, the more she kept taking them. She said she couldn't stand the pain. The pain was so severe, so she kept on taking overdoses. And I kept on saving her. And the more I saved her, the more she took the overdoses. Then early one morning, I woke up and found my mother gone. I rang the police station, and they told me that they found a person drowned in our local swimming pool. And I had the very sad part about it, I had to identify her.
Oh, dear.
Over at the morgue, but she was found in the Shepparton swimming pool, drowned.
Yes. Frank Campbell, people shouldn't feel responsible for this, should they?
Well, you know, the reality is it's going to be natural that when you've been the caregiver for someone and you've rescued them so many times and helped them get another day, that you're going to have that constant reminder of woulda, shoulda, coulda. And the reality is you were doing all you could, and your mother's behavior and the things that were going on were a reaction to the addiction to the pain medication and the withdrawal and the physical pain she was experiencing.
Helen, we're going to have to leave that call there. Helen, again, if you want to give us a call, and we can take some... give you some directions as to where to go. Sheila Clark, Frank Campbell, Adrian Bonner, we've only just touched the surface, but enough calls this evening to indicate that the work you're doing is extraordinarily worthwhile. So thank you for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to catch up with more on Sunday night, stay tuned.